Okay, good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Okay, there we go. I want to make sure you're still with me. I thank my colleagues who went before me. I'm Tanya Evans. I'm a professor of law at the University of New Hampshire School of Law, which is formerly known as the Franklin Pierce Law Center. And I am the chair of intellectual property and technology online programs. I write, speak, and teach about the intersections of copyright and technology. And I fell down the blockchain rabbit hole about 18 months ago and haven't survived yet. So I'm spending quite a bit of time talking about the intellectual property issues in or implicated by blockchain and distributed ledger technology. And so some of my marks will gravitate toward a connection between what my predecessors have said and also what technological tools might be used to further protect the rights of artists and innovators in the musical space. So I will pick up where my colleagues left off with the role of cumulative creation in music. One of the first legal or law review papers I wrote was titled Sampling, Looping, Mashing, Oh My, How Copyright Implicates Certain Protections for Copyright Artists. And that includes more than just music, but we'll spend our time and attention focused on music in particular. There's also a lot going on in various countries, what I describe as a seismic shift in the law, or perhaps a pendulum swing back to refocusing on the rights of creators and also of consumers who in this day and age actually don't just consume passively, but also seek to innovate. So I talk about them as being second generation creators or those who are borrowing or using quotation in various literary and creative mediums in order to create something new. That's the innovation, that's the forward progress that from a United States perspective is hardwired into our Constitution, which builds upon the Statute of Anne, which came from England. And finally, I will leave off with the role of technology in further protecting artists' rights. So in terms of cumulative creation in the US, there is much overlap and similarity because the United States is a member of the Berne Convention as well, and so we're held to certain standards, the 176 nations that was mentioned by Lionel. Originally conceived, however, it actually didn't apply to music. There were later iterations of the Copyright Act that began in the United States in 1909. By 1831, lyrics, so musical compositions, were protected. That protection was extended in 1790 version of the Act. And it wasn't until 1971 that sound recordings became protected. And so that's always interesting. There's a long history of protecting musical compositions, which is a separate copyright from the sound recordings on a master recording, for example. And it is interesting what's happening now. Just on October 11th, so this month, just a few weeks ago, or a couple of weeks ago, the President signed into law the Music Modernization Act. It was a major overhaul. It's the first major overhaul of the United States copyright in 20 years since the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act in 1998. Evidently, I don't know how it was done, but all of the stakeholders in the music industry came together to lobby Congress to enact certain protections, and I'll talk more about that as we move forward. Copyright exists automatically. So from the moment it's fixed and capable of being copied, it's in some what we call tangible medium of expression, then that is when copyright subsists. There are certain protections and reasons for registration that we won't go into, but it's important to note as a signatory to the Berne Convention that these rights exist automatically, which is the blessing and the curse in some respects when you have second generation creators who are trying to make sense of what is protected and what is left available and enough for the rest. When we talk about the rights, sometimes we brush past them, but it's the right to copy and to adapt, to distribute, to publicly perform if it's capable of being publicly performed or publicly displayed. And therefore, sampling and looping and mashing all trigger copyright inquiries. That's not the end of the inquiry because of what was described earlier as fair practice, or in U.S. parlance, fair use, and also de minimis use, that technically, even if something is protected, that we still want to leave enough space for what the law calls a trifle of loss, not even worth the effort of fighting about. Perhaps after 10 years in the case that was mentioned earlier, they finally came to that conclusion after wasting a good bit of time fleshing out the issues. And from that, it's important to talk about what happens when the law is either uncertain or where you have parties that don't have the deep pockets necessary to protect their interests. So I feel that the space for fair use and de minimis use has been shrunken down exponentially, not because the rights don't exist, but because people don't have the deep pockets to fight out in an open court. Because even if you're sued, or even if you sue someone, if you have to go to court, in some sense, you've already lost, particularly if you are an independent artist. I spent most of my time in some of the law review articles talking more broadly about music, but looking in particular at hip-hop law, hip-hop music, and more than music, the culture. And it's interesting what was said earlier, because we have this idea of borrowing or quotation, again, not just from a literary text, but in all areas of creativity subject to copyright. When I think about hip-hop music and the fact that DJing is really the backbone of hip-hop, and also understanding the origins and the role that citation, quotation, homage plays in the hip-hop music area. So, started in the Boogie Down Bronx, that's how you have to say it, which is in New York City in the early 70s. And it was quite by accident when DJ Kool Herc was DJing a party and isolated a heavy percussive beat to a recognizable R&B tune, and then he rapped over it simultaneously. And that was really the birth of hip hop, and it was taking a little bit of this and a little bit of that, those things that already existed, and creating something new and innovative, something we would call transformative, that would be the subject of a fair use or fair practice. It grew on from there, continuing to borrow from classic R&B hits at the time. It grew much more exponentially after that, and that music would be in the background. That also ushered in the idea of cutting and scratching, using two tables, a microphone, and a fader going back and forth to bring up and push back music. And that was an integral part of that type of music. Going beyond there, there was also, at the same time, these technological advancements. So moving from physically manipulating vinyl to doing so digitally, and being able to adjust music to speed it up, to slow it down, to compress it, to take those aural fragments and to create music. So the stock in trade was actually the beat and the music. They were used as tools of creativity that was, to quote Lionel a bit earlier, not weakness of imagination, but the height of imagination, of taking what already exists and making something new. So when I talk, Public Enemy is a classic example. So their greatest record of all time from PE or Public Enemy was It Takes a Nation to Hold Us Back. And that involves hundreds, literally, of aural fragments. I call it a musical collage. It would be cost prohibitive to create this at this time because of the licensing culture that would require an artist, if they were going to take one, let alone 300, to have to pay for them. But Public Enemy distinguished itself early as this sampling as art trailblazer, and many artists started to copy that as well. Their legendary status was the very reason that they were creating these musical collages. At the same time, not only the industry, but certainly the law was taking a keen interest in a negative way in the music, and making it, nobody cared when it was in, you know, a small basement in the Bronx, but they cared very much when hip-hop became a global phenomenon that pressed the issue from a rights perspective, when all of a sudden there was a mass infringement race to sue as many people as possible and to secure. And so artists were clearly negatively impacted from a sound recording perspective because samples are direct copies of a sound recording protected by copyright. And those infringement claims really broke the back of the industry and hip-hop music. And that also brought forth this idea of the negotiated licensing, where people are just not going to take any chances. They're going to err on the side of caution, figure out how much it's going to cost, and pay. Maybe they'll take one sample and loop it, as was talked about earlier, and not risk being sued. There's an interesting case in the United States known as Bridgeport v. Dimension Films. A lot of people talk about the Blurred Lines case, but that's really a plagiarism case. It's not a direct sampling. And so you have to go to the Bridgeport case to really see how a U.S. court might approach it. I will say, and so long story short about Bridgeport is the court held that there was no de minimis use, and any amount of a sample would be per se infringement. Now you can look through the entire act, and there are a lot of words, but those words aren't actually included. And so many other circuits disagree, and Nimmer on Copyright, the leading treatise author, also disagrees. But that is still the law in the Sixth Circuit, and it lends itself to something that's quite curious about whether or not there is any space for fair use, for de minimis use. And from the perspective of the United States law, this balance, when the copyright monopoly was created, that it would be for limited times, but ultimately would be returned to the public domain because it's this rich idea of creativity and innovation that spurs the development of society. So it's as if the law says, we'll let you borrow it for a while, but we're going to need it back. And by we mean the citizens, because this is ultimately important from the richness of history and creativity. So how is this evolving today? I mentioned this idea of the Music Modernization Act that was signed into law on October 11th. It combines three separate bills that are very important, and actually it's quite, again, interesting that the entire industry came together and supported the enactment of this act. The first title creates a new licensing collective, so there would no longer be this division of performing rights organizations collecting on behalf of their members and then giving them pennies on the dollar. Now you have one licensing collective, you have a new mechanical license that's been created, and a new fee dispute resolution system specifically for digital music. The Classics Act focused on and created what had never been in existence before, but a pre-1972 protection of sound recordings. So you might remember earlier I mentioned that 1971 going forward, sound recordings were protected, but those before that time were not. And so the Congress has created a protection for some of the old hits. They're giving them quite a window. So you'll see that it says, the right that didn't exist before this passed will now protect sound recordings that weren't protected until 2067. That's a few years. I'm not quite sure what limited times means anymore, but it's quite extraordinary to retroactively create rights in that way. And I'm agnostic about it, but it is really breathtaking to see what has been created. The final one focuses on producers of music. So oftentimes producers are including some type of creative element, but often don't get compensation, and so it compensates artists in that way. And so when I think about the future of digital music rights, and I also think of some ethical issues that come up here as well, I think of the ethical challenges when we think of all of the intermediaries in music that come between the artist and the user or the consumer. All the stops along the way, and from an ethics perspective, whether or not that is fair to the creator to get so little of the economic benefit of their creativity. So what are the current methods of distribution? And I'm speaking specifically about digital music, and the MMA focuses specifically on digital music. So there are actually over 30 different digital, has to be more than that at this point, but at least 30 different. I took a look at CD Baby before coming here about all of the different methods of digital distribution and how little if any of that remuneration makes its way to the artist. In my not-so-spare time, many years ago, performing performance poet, have a CD, and then sometimes I go in for S's and giggles just to see how little money I've made in a quarter, and it's quite insubstantial, but I do get pennies every now and then for people who are playing my music, and it'll be interesting to see what changes once you have some dedicated repository and distribution point. I put this up super small, so sue me, but it shows you all of the different intermediaries, again, between the artist creating music and then the consumer. It's a hodgepodge of intermediaries for composers, for sound recordings and public performances and all the licensing and distribution deals that an artist has to make. And so perhaps there's this better way, and maybe through technology, we might be able to remedy some of the legal challenges and some of the ethical issues that arise in creativity and distribution of those creations. At a very high level, just for a few minutes, for those who are not familiar with blockchain and its role at all in music, I just wanted to set that up. We talk about blockchain technology as the advent of Web 3.0, that it's called the Internet of Value. We've created a lot of value in Web 2.0. We talk all the time about data, data privacy, data breaches, and we sign up for a lot of free things not knowing that no app is truly free. And if they're giving it away, they're probably taking everything but your firstborn child. So how does that change in the next wave of technology? This is what computer network evolution looks like. First, centralized and static. You go to a website, you read it. You might go to a chat room, but there's no engagement. You move from there to something that's decentralized, where you have a few huge intermediaries, Facebook, Google, eBay, Yahoo, and they control the lion's share of the information that's disseminated. And in the Web 3.0 world, it's fully distributed. And that could be very powerful for creators in this day and age if they properly leverage that. And we'll talk about why. Blockchain is basically a distributed database. If you think about your text messages when you're group texting, everybody sees it, everybody has a copy of it. Just because you delete it on your phone doesn't mean that it's deleted everywhere else, right? It's this a novel way of arranging information that's replicated and shared and synchronized with a group of other computers. Generally speaking, it's permissionless. Generally speaking, it's public. It's transnational, so it removes borders, and it also removes the clogging point of intermediaries. And as we saw from the previous slide, there are many intermediaries in music. What would music data unchained look like? So certain metadata is involved. Who's the artist? What's the name of the album, the title track? The genre, there are bits of information that are very difficult to get, even if you're the artist, and that's an ethical problem as well, because the large intermediaries are the ones in control of the data that is generated by their artists. So, and it can often be incomplete, out of date, erroneous, there's a lack of transparency, and there's certainly a lack of trust. And those are all things, when you have the absence of trust in business, cause all sorts of ethical concerns. And so there are a couple of projects I wanted to let you know about. There's a longer list at the end of this slide presentation. I'm happy to share it with you. We can chat afterwards. But Dot Blockchain Media is one of the really exciting projects that is actually working with those various intermediaries to empower authors by creating a certain, what they call minimal viable data, so that there's not one siloed intermediary that controls everything, but it's actually shared. To further empower artists and users to find basic information. And finally, there's this group called Ujo Music, ujomusic.com. You might know Emotion Heap. She's a fantastic artist that decided to only release her music through Ujo Music. It's built and recorded on a blockchain, every transaction. She's able to allow people to buy instantaneously from her and receive money in crypto. She could code her smart contract so that she could be paid every time it was transferred, or have nothing. She can control her rights and permissions directly from the technology. So perhaps technology will alleviate some of the things that are greatest concern in the music industry from the artist's perspective, and quite frankly, also from the user's perspective. You're not going to be able to read all these necessarily, but I wanted to give you an idea of all of the projects being developed right now. Most of them are in beta and just shy of a white paper. So we're kind of years away from most of them being successful, but it will be really fascinating to see in the years ahead about how technology might be used. I think of the internet peer-to-peer technology as being, and digital technology as being, the bane of the existence of artists, where people can make perfect digital copies and share without exhausting. And blockchain changes that. So the same technology that was used to disempower artists in Web 2.0 might be used to empower them in Web 3.0. And I look forward to your conversation and your questions.